This CKNW podcast is brought to you by Destination Toyota in Burnaby, BC's number one Toyota dealer for the sales purchase experience.
I read a fascinating book on the weekend. It's titled The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and Other Inspiring Stories of Pioneering Brain Transformation. Barbara Arrowsmith Young is my guest. This is her story, at least it's primarily her story, and it is a fascinating one. Barbara Arrowsmith Young is the director of the Arrowsmith School and Arrowsmith School Program, and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is very complex and very complicated, but I'm going to ask you to try to simplify it at least for the beginning of our discussion. Can you describe what we call a learning disorder? But from a personal perspective, tell me what it was like for you when you were a youngster.
When I was growing up, I was identified in grade one, and this would be in 1957. And at that time, there wasn't even the term learning disabled. So I was identified as a child that wasn't learning as other children were. And my teacher told my mother I had a mental block. So I actually thought I had a wooden cube in my head that made learning difficult. And I wasn't too far off. I didn't have a wooden cube, but I had blockages, as I was later to learn, in my brain that made certain aspects of learning difficult. So I read everything backwards. I wrote backwards. If I was doing mathematics and the question was 12 plus 15, I would reverse the numbers and add 21 plus 51. And then when I put the answer down, I would actually even reverse the answer. So it was very, very confusing for my teacher. And I actually got the strap in grade one because my teacher thought I was doing this willfully. And this was just the way my brain was wired.
Must have been very helpful.
It was very helpful. It didn't really address the problem. And there weren't even tutors at that time. So my mother, who had been a teacher, basically created flashcards and drilled me at lunch, drilled me after school. I joke that I became a workaholic in grade one. But that's what it took for me to get through school. I had a phenomenal visual memory, almost a photographic memory, and an auditory memory. So I memorized everything. But I didn't understand. I didn't understand mathematics, relationships, like a fraction, 1/4. That didn't mean anything to me. I didn't understand that it meant one part out of four, or things like my aunt. I couldn't understand how could my aunt be my aunt, but also be my mother's sister. Anything that was abstract, jokes. I never got jokes because they're relationships. There's irony. So I would learn to laugh when other people did. So it was very, very isolating. It was isolating socially. I also had a problem. I didn't know where the left side of my body was in space. I was very clumsy, so nobody wanted me on their sports team because my strategy, if a ball was coming at me, would be to run in the other direction. And so people knew I wouldn't be an asset to any athletic team. So I couldn't excel academically. I couldn't excel socially because I didn't understand what people were saying to me. And I couldn't excel athletically. So it was a very, it was an unhappy childhood. I got through with memory. I memorized everything. But I always knew that it felt like my life was built on a shaky foundation, like kind of a house of cards that if somebody just poked in one direction, it would all fall apart because I knew I didn't understand. I would memorize and then hope that what I'd memorized matched whatever somebody was asking me.
You likened the disability to that of a soldier, in this case a specific soldier, who had been injured in battle with a bullet in the brain. You were born without the bullet.
Yes, I was born with parts of my brain that weren't working properly. And my epiphany was, I remember very well, it was August of 1977 when somebody gave me a book which changed my life. And it was The Man with the Shattered World, which told the story of this Russian soldier, Zazetsky, who in 1943 in World War II, he was a very, very intelligent young man. But he got a bullet wound to his very specific part of his brain in the left hemisphere. And it described all of the things that he could no longer do. And this was like, this man was living my life. I mean, he couldn't tell time. Up until the age of 26, I couldn't read an analog clock. He couldn't understand relationships. And he'd been good at mathematics before. Now he couldn't understand math. So all of the things that that I couldn't do from birth, he couldn't do as a result of this wound. So now I knew that my problem had its source in part of my brain that wasn't working well. Before I knew something was very, very wrong, but I had no idea what it was. And to create a solution for something, you have to understand the source of the problem to create the solution. So this was the first piece of the puzzle, was parts of my brain aren't working. And then I came across another line of research that was coming out of Berkeley, a brilliant man named Rosenzweig, who was studying rats. And he was one of the first people looking at neuroplasticity, which simply put means that our brain can change. When I grew up, the idea was your brain is fixed. Basically, what you're born with is what you live with. Now we know through stimulation, through exercise, mental exercise, we can actually change the brain at a physiological level, which leads to better learning. So I thought maybe I could create an exercise to stimulate my brain. And I figured that humans must have more neuroplasticity than rats. So I started this in 1978, created the first exercises for myself, and saw the incredible transformation where I could do things that I couldn't do before. So I knew I was living proof of human neuroplasticity.
What kind of exercise?
I started with clocks, because I hadn't been able to tell time. And it wasn't that I wanted to get better at telling time, but I wanted to force my brain to process relationships, because that's what I couldn't do. I couldn't make connections between
the big hand and the little hand.
Exactly. That's what a clock is. It's a relationship. Yeah. And I could never make relationships. I didn't understand cause and effect. I didn't understand why things happened. There was no logic in my world. So by drawing clocks, I had to get somebody to help me because I couldn't tell time. But eventually I got really fast at telling the time on a two-handed clock. And then I realized I needed to make it more complex, a harder workout for my brain. So I added a third hand. And then I added a fourth hand because I was forcing my brain now to process and hold four relationships. And at that point, it was about 3 to 4 months into the cognitive exercise, I knew I was living proof of human neuroplasticity. My brain had changed. I could read things and understand them as I was reading them. Whereas before, I might have to read a page 20, 30, 40 times before I would understand what was being said. And often I didn't. I talked about
it. But you did that. I mean, most people would not. They would give up. The fact that you would, I mean, it speaks to your persistence, certainly, that you would go to that effort to read something 20 times.
Yes, I was very driven. I mean, I think it's just part of my nature, my personality. So absolutely, I see a lot of individuals that get frustrated and give up. But I kept driving, and I kept driving thinking there had to be a better way. There had to be a solution. I did not want to be condemned with having to live with these learning disorders all of my life. And once I saw the change, I then decided, you know, can I take this work out into the world and work with other people that are struggling with learning problems? And that was the beginning of my program. And now I have programs for 19 different cognitive functions, from, you know, the individual that can't remember information, like auditory memory, as they listen. In fact, I had a pilot who had that problem. And if you think about, you know, when he's flying in the airspace and the air traffic controller gives the instructions, his strategy was to ask the air traffic controller to repeat them over and over again. But my worry always was, what if that air traffic controller is busy and can only say those instructions once, and the pilot can't remember them? But we worked on that area, and now he can hold information. The individual that can't read nonverbally, so they're socially awkward, we have programs for that. The child that can't remember the visual look of a word, so has dyslexia, we have programs for that. So I can now address 19 different cognitive functions.
I looked in the index of your book because I'd read a good deal of it, and I'd not heard the term autism used. And having done a fair bit of work in terms of interviewing people, you know, families with autism, I was a little surprised at that. Is there a reason?
My work doesn't address autism per se, and part of that is, for my work to be effective, I have to understand the cognitive function or what that area does to create an exercise. And we don't really understand all of what's going on in the brain in terms of somebody that's struggling with autism. So until there's an understanding, one can't really create a program. I have worked with people with Asperger's, mm-hmm. with very high-functioning autism, and I have a program that's very effective that helps the person read the nonverbal cues to navigate the social world. So that program, it isn't changing the Asperger's, but it's addressing the nonverbal component so they can have good social relationships.
You asked a really interesting question in the book. Why are educators still telling parents that learning disabilities are lifelong? given the great weight of evidence for neuroplasticity, why are cognitive exercises not more widely recognized as a treatment for learning disabilities?
That is a really good question. And I think partly this work comes out of neuroscience. It comes out of understanding the brain and that whole concept of neuroplasticity, which is a different discipline than education. It didn't grow out of education. And I think it takes time as a paradigm shift. So, you know, if people have been educated in a certain way to look at the brain or the treatment programs as the brain is fixed, they're going to be using compensations, workarounds, strategies, which all have benefit, but they're not addressing and changing the root cause of the problem. And what I see, I mean, I started this work over 30 years ago, and at that point, not too many people were really interested in hearing about these concepts or ideas. I mean, really now in the last 7-8 years, we know that the brain is capable of changing. And there's much more receptivity for this kind of work and this kind of program. And the program now is in 40 schools in North America. And this week we just started in a school in Sydney, Australia. And it's here in three schools in the Vancouver region, a school in Victoria, the Eton Arrowsmith School. So there's much, much more receptivity now.
But how many kids are getting the help they need? My concern is that we're losing yet another generation of people who suffer learning disabilities, but who have the capacity to do something akin to what you've done, and they're not getting the help they need.
Yes, I would say right now it's still a tiny percentage that we're reaching through this work. And I think what it really would take, I mean, every child that's through this work is an ambassador for this program because they go back out into the world with very changed cognitive functioning. But I think it's going to take some forward-thinking, you know, politicians, some forward-thinking educators to say, you know, what we're doing has some benefit, but they're probably is value, or there is value in looking at this kind of work. And my real vision is that every child starting in grade one, imagine if part of the day they did cognitive exercises and part of the day they did academic curriculum, then school would become a place where you go to exercise and work out your brain, and then you go to learn things. Because what do we learn with? We learn with our brain. And what this would do would be children that say by grade 3 or 4 would be identified as learning disabled would never have that stigma because it would be addressed and it would be a normal part of curriculum.
Talking with Barbara Arrowsmith Young, her fascinating new book, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. We'll be back to talk more with her, but I also want to hear from you. I'm sure many of you would be fascinated by this topic and perhaps touched by it. 604-280-9898. Toll free 1-877-399-9898. You're with Bill Good on the Chorus Radio Network, and my phones are open to you. Talking with Barbara Arrowsmith Young, the author of The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. And those of you who listen to the program on a regular basis know I don't tend to rave about books just because I've read them. But I just found this to be so fascinating, and I'm finding the conversation to be the same. But I also remember I had a chuckle. I was on the ferry on the weekend, and I was reading the part of your book where you said you were watching 60 Minutes one night, and suddenly it was like a light went on. And I'm not quoting you, but that was the sense I had. So ever since, I've been thinking, well, if I watch 60 Minutes enough, will I finally get math? I don't think it's going to happen. But tell me what that was about.
Well, it again, because of the problem I had, I did not understand what I listened to. I mean, I just didn't make connections. And if you think about 60 Minutes, there are a lot of connections. I mean, there's logic, there's reasoning, there's stories that are being developed. And I couldn't understand it. And I always used to watch with a friend, and he would be interpreting what was going on and translating for me, in a sense. And this was after I had done the four-handed clock. So I'd gotten up to that level in the cognitive exercise where I was starting to make connections and relationships. So here we were watching 60 Minutes again, and my friend was just turning to interpret for me, and I turned first and told him exactly what was going on, and I had never been able to do that.
Wow.
I was able to make those connections in real time and understand as things were unfolding, and I had never been able to do that.
It must have been a remarkable moment for you.
It was. I mean, I almost like leapt off the couch. I was so excited because before I lived in what I called lag time. I was always hours behind everybody else in understanding anything, and often I never did understand it. And now I was understanding in real time. I was understanding as things happened. And it's just so much more efficient and effective to be able to actually process information and understand it as it's happening, rather than to go away and spend hours trying to figure it out. And that's what the power of this work is. Once the cognitive function is in place, all of the learning that resides there just goes forward naturally, and it's just normal, and it happens.
Let me get to some calls. Kathy, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to, I've followed Barbara Arrowsmith's work. I just have amazing respect for her. We took a leap of faith about 7 years ago. Our son attended the Eaton Arrowsmith School, and he graduated. He went back to, would be high school at that point, and he graduated from high school with scholarship. He's gone to university and is in an engineering program currently. It's changed his life. It's just amazing.
Wow. Now, let me ask you a personal question. Did it cost you a lot of money?
It's tremendously expensive, and we had already done a lot of intervention. I have worked with the public school system trying to get them so that every parent doesn't have to reinvent the wheel on their child's area of problem. And I didn't want to go to send my kids to private school or my son to private school, but we decided I couldn't live with myself if we didn't do everything that we could for him. We had seen what that had done previously in our family.
The unfortunate thing, and you must think about this a lot, Barbara Arrowsmith Young, that there are thousands of people out there who could be helped, should be helped, can't afford to get the help they need.
That's correct, and that's why this needs to also be in the publicly funded system. In Toronto, it is in the Toronto Catholic District School Board, which is a publicly funded board. So there, parents don't have to pay tuition to access the program. I mean, this program needs to be broadly available, both in private schools and in public schools, so parents can make a choice as to what works best for them.
Back with more of your calls. If you're on the line, please stay on the line. Alex, Allison, we'll get to as many calls as we can right after the news headlines next. Talking with the woman who changed her brain, that's the name of her book. Barbara Arrowsmith Young is my guest, and I'll get right back to calls in just a moment, but a school in Australia has just opened, just introduced.
That's correct. The program just started this week on Monday. It's grades 9 and 10. It's in Sydney in the Catholic Education Office, which is the Catholic education system, and they're starting with 20 students. We trained the teachers from Australia this summer. They're back in Sydney, and it's very exciting.
How much training does it take?
We have a 3-week summer training course, and then I have staff in Toronto that works throughout the year with the teachers via the internet, via telephone, just to provide support.
But could most teachers in the public system learn your methods with relative ease?
Yes. I mean, we've got a very, very good training system and a very good ongoing professional development and support system. So if a school board wanted to take on this program, they would just have to contact us. We would dialogue and we could train the teachers.
Why don't more?
That's a very, very good question, and I don't have a good answer for that.
You mentioned Australia. I've just learned through you that there have been several families that have moved here from Australia in order to avail their children your teaching methods.
Yes, there are 27 families that have moved from Australia and some from New Zealand to go to Eaton Arrowsmith School here in Vancouver to access the program, because until now it wasn't available in Australia, and even now it's just working with 20 students, so it's a small percentage.
Alex, good morning.
Oh, good morning. I've never called into a talk show before.
Gotcha.
Never been compelled to. But I do have a son at Eaton Arrowsmith. And it's, pardon me.
It's okay.
It's remarkable.
Tell me how.
Well, basically, when he went into Eaton Arrowsmith, if he had a conversation with anybody, I had to stand beside him and explain it to the person he was talking to. He seemed to be distant. We have taken him to incredible amount of specialists, physio, occupational therapy, biofeedback, energy work. He went to a school called Small Talk when he was younger. He did speech therapy, even hyperbaric chambers, went to other things called sounded ears. I mean, the full spectrum. We tried everything. And I've never read Barbara's book.
No, it's just come out.
Well, there's been other books, I think. Anyhow, I've seen it on my desk for a while. There's some book about changing the brain, and I've never gone to any of her talks. Frankly, with all the things I've taken my kid to, I've been overloaded with paperwork. I just wanted to see results, and it is remarkable.
How old is he?
He is about 14.
And how long has he been in the program?
I think this is his fourth year. He's not going to be, he'll be graduating this year, but he's actually going to graduate partway through. So, it's a lot of work for the kids. It's tough, repetitive. I would have to say probably incredibly boring, but it seems to work.
It does. I mean, and that's what it takes to change the brain. It takes a lot of repetition of the cognitive exercise. And what I say to the students is it takes a lot of courage to do this work because we're not working around the problem area. To do the work, we have to go right into their area of difficulty, and they have to face every day the challenge of that difficulty to exercise that part of their brain. But what happens is once they start to see change, which is about the 3 to 4 month mark in, it becomes incredibly rewarding and motivating because they want more and more and more of that change. So even though the exercises are repetitive and somewhat boring, it's seeing the cognitive change where they can do things that they couldn't do before that then spurs them on to keep working.
I wonder how many people who are currently in some form of custody, had they gotten this kind of help, would never have wound up in jail.
I think a large percentage. I mean, the research is suggesting that somewhere around 60% of people that end up in the prison population have learning disabilities or learning disorders. And several years ago, I had two individuals sentenced to me by the court system.
Sentenced to you?
Sentenced to me, where they couldn't think ahead to think of the consequences of their actions. So they were very, very impulsive. And we worked on those cognitive functions. And that was probably 20, 25 years ago. They never got into trouble with the law after that. So, I mean, one of the groups I would love to work with would be the young offenders before they're sort of hardened in the system and where we can change the future for these individuals. We can give them the capacity to reason, to understand, to plan, to create consequences, to understand the consequences of their actions so they'll make different choices.
Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, Barbara. I'm a parent that I had two children go to your UBC campus with Howard Eden, Mark Watson, and a bunch of other folks and teachers there. And what I found is I'm skeptic to everything. And it's just like, no, this ain't going to work. This ain't going to work. Kids were in regular school. We had some learning issues, went and got them tested, found out that they needed some extra help. Kids weren't doing well at their regular school. They were getting bullied, and I pulled them out, and next thing you know, my phone rings. It's a gentleman named Howard Eaton on the other end saying, "Hey, Dave, we got a couple spots at your school." "What's your name again?" "Howard." "Oh, okay." So I went. There was a two-year waiting list because the school was just small, just getting going about 7 years ago, and I tell you, you invest now. I got my kids back. They moved on to another school. They're going to graduate. And I couldn't thank the system any more than just calling in and saying thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
A nice note to end on, at least for this time around. Again, fascinating story. I thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And once again, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain is the name of this of the book. You're with Bill Good on the Chorus Radio Network. When we come back, well, RIM is no more. They've changed their name. Gee, the BC Liberals didn't do that. Wonder if it's going to help BlackBerry. Back right after this. Well, today Research in Motion, soon to be called BlackBerry, unveiled its first two next-generation smartphones, the BlackBerry Z10 and the BlackBerry X10. BlackBerry still boasts about 80 million users worldwide, including millions of employees at government, corporate, and private businesses who are handed a BlackBerry by their employer, but can it meet the new competition in the market, the Androids, the iPhones? Peter Nowak is a writer and technology expert for Canadian Business Magazine, and Mr. Nowak, I gather we have reached you on your brand new BlackBerry.
Yes, indeed. So this is the first phone call I'm taking on it, so I can't tell you what the sound quality is going to be like.
Well, you sound fine.
That's good.
What do you think of it, the little you've seen?
Well, so far, it's a pretty nice phone. The Z10 is it's coming out here in Canada next week, and it's out in the UK tomorrow. The Q10 is out. They didn't give a release date on that one, but most people believe it's going to be March. That's the one that I think a lot of people are waiting for, because that's the one with the actual keyboard on it. Most people who are BlackBerry fans are fans of it because of the physical keyboard. So the one that's coming out next week, the Z10, it's a touchscreen only. But both phones, the operating system that powers them, the BlackBerry 10, is it's impressive in several ways. It's very fluid, it's very slick, and they've done some smart things with it. For example, there's the thing I really like is it's called a hub, BlackBerry Hub, and it's basically a unified inbox. So you sign up all of your accounts, whether it's email, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever, and it puts all that stuff in one spot. And,
okay.
Some other phones have done this, but this one does it quite nicely.
Now, I was on a BlackBerry for about 10 years. I didn't really like the keyboard because it's so small, and I'm used to a much bigger keyboard, obviously, but I lived with it. And then I got an iPhone, and it took me a week or two to get really comfortable with the touch tone aspect of it, but I grew to really like it quite quickly. What would attract me back to BlackBerry? I guess that's the question in my mind, because they have to regain considerable market share, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They've lost a lot of subscribers, especially in North America over the last few years. I think you're one of the exceptions, as far as I know, as far as people who prefer the keyboard to the actual physical keyboard, to the virtual keyboard, that is. there's a few things that they're trying to lure people back with. So the hub is one of those things I mentioned. The other thing is they seem to be trying to go for the all things to all people approach. BlackBerry's always been known as the business phone, and I think they're trying to appeal to a much larger audience now. And one of the things that they're doing is this thing called Balance, BlackBerry Balance. So it's basically, it lets you set up two different profiles on the BlackBerry. One is for all your personal stuff, right? For your photos or your games or your music or whatever. And then the other one is for your work stuff. So your work-related emails, your employer can actually approve certain apps and that sort of thing. So what ends up happening is you keep those two profiles separate. So if you ever leave your job, your employer can actually wipe that stuff off your phone. So it's an effort to try to get people off of, a lot of people have been carrying two phones, one for work, one for their personal life. So it's an effort to try to get rid of that. And that's a pretty smart thing. Others have tried this, but this is another big step forward for BlackBerry.
Now, I heard this morning that it comes in at about $600.
Yeah, they haven't talked about the off-contract price. The on-contract price in Canada for on a three-year contract is going to be $149. I know I talked to one of the carriers at the event, and they weren't quite sure of the off-contract price, but they will be selling it off-contract. But that sounds about right. That sounds about what these types of phones are generally selling at.
Now, the market hasn't been overwhelmed on what it's seen today. The BlackBerry shares or RIM shares have actually dropped. Would the company be worried about that in the short term?
Well, yeah, they've got two problems. One is kind of short term, the other is longer term. The short term issue is that the phones are not coming out, or the Z10 at least is not coming out in the U.S. until likely mid-March. And the U.S., of course, is the all-important market for any phone manufacturer. I'm not quite sure why that is. I've heard that it's because some of the carriers there, or at least one of the carriers there, was late to get it into testing or something to that effect. The longer-term problem they have, though, is in terms of apps. Some people say that the number of apps on a phone, Apple and Android, they both have about 600,000 apps available for their phones. Some people say that doesn't matter, but it does actually matter, because we're getting into this whole world of the Internet of Things, which is kind of this jargon that we've heard. But it's basically where all electronics that are coming out today, whether it's a television, a refrigerator, even cars, all of these things are hooking up to the Internet, and they're eventually ending up in apps that let you control or monitor them. And so that's where numbers are really starting to matter. And Apple and Android have a huge lead there. Whether BlackBerry can make up that shortfall is the biggest question, I think, surrounding the company.
Well, we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you.
Peter Nowak, writer and technology expert for Canadian Business Magazine. Jessica, with your feedback on the morning, just ahead.